Education Committee will now come to order. The meeting is Monday, April 26th. The time is 8:03 a.m. in the Bay News Committee Room in the High School of Capitol in Hill. Members of House Education present are Co-Chair Representative Andy Story, Representative Mike Klein, Representative Brian Kelly, Representative Mike Cox, Representative Connor Matthews, myself, and myself, Representative Jerry Brown, Co-Chair. We have a quorum to conduct business, and before we begin, I'd like to remind everyone to please silence their cell phones. Tonight, our recording secretary is Christopher Dillon, and Kelsey Knight, our Carolina moderator, assisting with track and field conference of support. Thank you both. Today, we will continue our work on Representative Clark's House Bill 164, Early Education Programs, Reading and Virtual Education, followed by Representative Wall's House Bill 21, and faculty member to the University Board of Regents. First, our House Bill 154. If you folks would like to come up and be seated and introduce yourselves.
Representative Chris Tuck from West Austin County Grants District 23, also known as the Bay Business District. Thank you again for hearing House Bill 164 for the second time. Also known as the last time we did that. This is a long-term investment in the last of children and their future. And that, as we do primary care, we have three people who are invited this morning. Today we have Stevie Burgess from Rowan Public Schools, who is the superintendent. Tom Thaymeyer with the UNI Alaska, and the UNI Alaska Engineer Wood, who is the director of the Alaska Association of School Boards. And then we also have Ida Tester available for any questions about the fiscal notes. And then James Ripper from the Finance and Sports Services Department of Education.
Thank you, Representative Tom. So you'd like us to
yes, I see that anybody has any questions.
That would be good. Answer any questions. All right, we will. So we have Mr. Burgess and we will get you for time. All right. Okay. Oh, is that my home screen number? 20 screens. Sorry, guys. Okay. Let's see, Jimmy Burgess, are you with us? Let's move on to Tom Blyler. Morning, Tom. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Introduce yourself and your affiliation and proceed with your festival.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Klingler, and I'm a 25-year teacher in Alaska. I'm currently serving as the Indiana Alaska president. In that capacity, I'm here this morning on behalf of those 12 Alaska educators across the state who represent the vast majority of classroom teachers, specialists, and teacher aides who have firsthand experience in delivering lessons, reading instruction, and creating environments conducive to student learning. I'm happy to represent them while they're doing exactly that for our students in classes across the state right now. As Alaska's professional educators, we put students first when it comes to public education and to policymaking. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 164 today. Because this is only the second hearing of this bill before this committee in the House this year, I thought it would be helpful to provide a little bit of a brief context and frame of conversation. Educators have been engaged in working directly on these policies since the last session. My predecessor, Tim Parker, convened a reading action team of our members and educators and reading experts from around the state last year, and they've continued to dig into the details of the various iterations of the reading bills, including the policies contained here in House Bill 164. Thank you, Representative Cook, for introducing this legislation. Plus, this bill represents what's possible when legislators, department officials, and stakeholders work together to craft evidence-based policy that puts students and student learning first. As a social studies teacher myself, and actually even as a former Air Force member, it pleases me greatly to see the process there on this particular issue. It represents the epitome of civic engagement. It's really a model of how government is supposed to work on the people, by the people, for the people, right? Engaging all the stakeholders. I don't have to tell Representative Drummond that she participated on the committee, but for everyone else, this conversation actually started almost 5 years ago now. In September of 2016, with Commissioner Duncan's leadership in convening the Alaska Education Challenge. According to longtime education policy observers, the Alaska Education Challenge represented the largest and most effective convening of stakeholders, parents, educators, administrators, and policymakers who built consensus and crafted final public commitments and trajectories. For the first time in so many years, we truly had all hands on deck focused on improving student outcomes. House Bill 164 is a culmination of sorts of these efforts. Arguably addresses all five of the priorities that emerged from Alaska's Education Challenge, but three of them directly. First of all, to close the achievement gap by ensuring equitable educational rigor and resources. Secondly, to improve the safety and well-being of students through school partnerships with families, communities, and tribes. And thirdly, and probably most directly, to support all students to reach a grade level by the end of third grade. In fact, I'll quote in part from the Alaska Education Challenge document. It says, research suggests that school readiness at an early age is one critical strategy for improving student outcomes and closing racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic achievement gaps, unquote. Now, the collaborative effort with the Alaska Education Challenge crystallized in the legislation last session. Of course, over the course of the current stakeholder engagement efforts, administrators, educators, and many advocates from all across Alaska who work together to craft policy language that puts students first. Educators felt like they were heard, respected, and participated and consulted in the policy-making process. So now it's time for the House Education Committee and its members. If you are joining the process, you can consider House Bill 164. And Alaska's educators are here for you, standing by to inform your efforts. As subject matter experts on the front lines working with students. But culturally relevant and sustaining quality reading program is a good start. Sound pedagogy, best practices, and reading instruction is absolutely essential. And culturally appropriate interventions and supports for students are also necessary. That said, Alaska educators know that any effort to improve reading and student outcomes in Alaska needs to begin with enhanced early learning opportunities. It's an unfortunate fact that Alaska is one of only a handful of states that does not offer statewide voluntary pre-K education. In comparison, the gap overlooked in states which have been cited as leading successes, like Florida, Mississippi, and others, in fact do offer such voluntary early childhood education programs. We care deeply about how this legislation will impact the work we do every day and the students we serve. I'm also encouraged to know that this committee is digging into the details and carefully considering these policies. As parents, grandparents, and community members, we all want kids to be successful in school and later on in life. As you're aware, Alaska students are among the most unique and diverse in the country. Our state has 21 official languages and is a long-time tapestry of indigenous cultures, norms, and traditions. As you know, Chair Perlin and others on the committee, the students of the Hickman School District, where I teach, from where you live, come to schools from homes that speak over 100 different languages. Unfortunately, it's also the case, according to a report in 2020 from the All-Alaska Pediatric Partnership, that fully 36% of our young people ages 0 to 8 live in poverty. It's more than a third. Alaska also has the highest rate of child maltreatment in the nation. The state's outcome of the Milk Project is showing that one-third of all of our children have had a report of maltreatment with the Office of Children's Services before the age of 8. Young children in Alaska are more likely even to die before the 8th birthday than their peers naturally. The report goes on to detail that only one-third of Alaska's children start kindergarten ready, and low-income children are even less likely to be well equipped to start their education. Furthermore, our state currently invests Professor of General Finance in Early Childhood Education. So, the simple fact is that many of us, the students, arrived to school unprepared. There are many factors, of course, that contribute to this unfortunate reality. Some students simply don't have access to early learning, others may come from homes that are ill-equipped or unable to provide early learning support for their children. And I could, of course, like you, I find these issues to be very troubling. If we're serious, though, about improving reading proficiency by third grade, we absolutely must expand access to high-quality, voluntary pre-kindergarten education by making it available to the students who need it most. This has been shown to be the most effective way to increase school readiness, improving both academic and social-emotional skills. The gains of literacy, of course, in elementary school outcomes, but they last well in the middle school and continue to benefit our communities and state, even as those students move into adulthood. So it's heartening that this bill moves Alaska in the right direction to address some of these issues. As policymakers, I recognize that you have a real challenge and appreciate the urgency with which this legislation is brought forward in order to help our Alaska students most in need. With those challenges in mind, and in appreciation of the work accomplished, Alaska's educators are standing by in support of their policymaking efforts. It's easy to say that Alaska spends more per capita on students, but I'm sure everyone on this committee would agree that we have a state that simply doesn't compare to others in so many ways. No less when we talk about making sure kids in Alaska have what they need to succeed. The distances, the climate, the high cost of energy, transportation, and even food in many of our communities makes Alaska truly unique. And of course, those challenges are greater than in most places. We have a good sense of what we need to help our kids succeed, and standardized testing alone can capture the comprehension of students who are just learning English or preserving an indigenous language. That kind of tells us that a student has a bright future who starts truly in school, despite the fact that there may be some dark things happening in their home. We'll never be able to tell from the test when there's a spark that ignites a student's love of reading. But it's also important. Our ability to measure the success is complex and multivariate. Educators and everyone here knows that our students are more than a test score. Alaska students deserve better than that. Their younger brothers and sisters lose the opportunity for early childhood education based on their performance on a standardized test. So we applaud the inclusion of culturally responsive requirements and the opportunity for students to demonstrate their mastery of reading by means other than a high stakes test. There are some concerns. What is true for Alaska students today in their education will be true for them when these provisions are set to expire. In fact, their need for pre-K education, high-quality reading programs, and additional intervention supports are far more likely to increase than not. It's not a coincidence that there are about 1,000 fewer certificated teachers working in Alaska right now than there were a decade ago after years of flat funding, the additional strains on our system caused by inflation, and a broken retirement system. Consecutive years where the legislature was debating cuts and didn't finish the budget work on time led to multiple years of pink slips for established educators. And it's that same mentality about education funding that also caused for this bill to sunset. But I'd be remiss if I didn't stop here to thank and acknowledge the incredible work done by the House of Representatives and supporting Ali and forward funding of digital public education, and for looking at full funding of broadband reimbursement. Especially after a vote last week, or the week before, I want to thank you on behalf of all educators for the strong support of students and commitment to public education. We are grateful and hope that you will also provide enduring stability for our pre-K education students in the coming years. Educators believe that our youngest students would benefit far more from ongoing program review, reporting, and engagement with parents and educators, administrators, and school board members rather than sunset provisions. This legislation could represent a turning point, and it will make a difference if we let it. I encourage you to make this a new bill in public education in Alaska. Our kids deserve nothing less than a commitment from the adults in the room to make sure that as many of them as possible that are arriving at school ready to work. Thank you so much for your time and the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, sir.
present, I need to recognize that Representative Cosby told us about being 11 p.m. and also that Senator Tom Bennett has been with us since we were there. Any questions for Mr. Cuero? Representative Cosby. Thank you again for all of your testimony this morning. Really appreciate your work on education here in Alaska and talking about the importance of the policy that we're considering today. As we've been working through understanding the pretty significant piece of legislation, the pre-K section is voluntary where a particular policy as it relates to reading interventions would be considered mandatory, and I was hoping you could speak to, as you worked through understanding the different types of assessments and reading interventions and work that would be required of teachers across Alaska, can you speak to how those different assessments would integrate atop all the other kind of standardized assessments that students are required to take and what that might look like in a classroom environment?
Yes, thank you for the question. Through the chair, Representative Sapkowski, I would hope that that process is outlined through D would be one that, again, would engage stakeholders, educators, administrators, and talk about that very issue. We wouldn't want to create a situation here where we're having an over-reliance on testing. Certainly, we need to assess students, but there are tools that exist already, like MAP tests, that are already being used that could be incorporated into this process to inform progress for students. MAP testing is used by virtually every district already, although not every district, and it's a great way to see where kids are at, but the information goes directly to the classroom teacher. It's not one of those tests where you test students and don't see the results until the next year, and by then you have different students and all that sort of thing. So I think there are processes that can be made available. And in addition, I would hope that adequate professional development would be provided and future voice in terms of allowing those educators the freedom to be able to teach the kids that they know in the ways that they know best in those classrooms. So this should provide an overall structure. This should provide resources and support for students and educators in supporting the students. But it shouldn't be so, overbearing is not quite the right word, but it shouldn't be so overbearing that it becomes a hindrance to what we're trying to accomplish. It should be empowering teachers and students to achieve their potential.
Has there been consultation with teachers broadly throughout the state on different reporting requirements that would be required of teachers in the classroom and the time that it would take for these assessments to be conducted in the classroom environment?
No, we haven't done a broad survey or membership. Difficult to communicate with that many, but we did convene, as I said, mentioned in my testimony, Tim Proctor, our previous president, convened a reading action team that does consist of our members throughout the state who have looked at the policies more closely. I think some of those details that you're concerned about maybe remain to be seen, and certainly we are. That team continues to meet, and we're happy to engage in a conversation and look at those proposals and considerations as well.
Thank you, Manager. Is there an opportunity to ask the department a question on this?
Let's see.
commissioners on the phone this morning.
Yes, good morning. For the record, Karen Mulvey, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education. Can you hear me, Madam Chair? To the representative, if I'm understanding your question correctly, you're wondering about the stringency of the programs. If I could get some clarification on your question, I could possibly answer it more effectively.
I think that's one of the biggest concerns that we have with the last committee on this bill. I was acting pursuant as it relates to, so as I understand, the reading intervention section of the bill is mandatory where other sections are voluntary. And I had asked a question about support that DEED would provide for teachers conducting the assessments in the classroom. As we see in Section 35, administering screening or assessment tools to 3% a year, that DEED would be required to provide support that teachers there, as well as looking at some of these other assessments. And the question that I had for the bill sponsor was related to what would that support look like, if you could speak to the anticipated stringency in the classroom environment, and particularly you could speak to, I guess, the department's mission there.
Right, thank you, City Chair Representative Valkowski. As Tom Kleinerman mentioned in his comments, most districts have an assessment process in place, and a part of that balanced assessment system includes an early literacy screener. And so for most teachers in the classroom, that wouldn't be a new concept. What we would hope for is to have some uniformity in the way that that's being administered, so we as a department can support the entire state. So that would be a common tool. There's a number of tools that are available at different levels throughout the state. But those particular early literacy screening tools address the five main components of reading, which great body of research has shown those five components to be the main indicators for student success in reading. So, in my view, and how most classroom teachers look at assessment and instruction as being very intricately interwoven into their practice. In fact, as educators, most educators assess all the time in a classroom as a former kindergarten teacher. I began assessing from the first day in school as I watched students come in and how they entered the classroom and making some conclusions from the very first. So assessment and instruction are two sides of the same coin. So as a department, we would support educators and the use of the tools, how to use the information we gathered from the tools, and then how to implement that into their instructional practice. So if that didn't answer your question, I'm happy to go on and on about reading instruction. So what about questions?
Set standards across the state, but that's the universal part of that. And then once we get into Burger Gage and 12, that's where we have the re-intervention, and that portion being mandatory. So you have to separate the two. What was mandatory, what was there was this Center for Race in Harper. It is compared to what the every school district has reading programs that are mandatory. You have to have reading, but this doesn't say the universal standard. I think that this is a booster line relative to the school that people want to learn to use. Yet the goal of the department is to provide sports needed to identify the number of districts already have different ways of measuring and assessing not a reading capacity and literacy. The district, the department's goal would be to support those. Those evidence-based or enrollment processes that was just produced well ones that have been mentioned here in our district recently now. If there was a request from the district to have a parallel process, the department would this bill would continue to support that process as long as it identified the scientific reading as a component. And then the last thing that we think is important to make is that not every child is the self. The multiple assessments are up to 3 times over a year for struggling students to monitor progress to see that it can be a thing you found progressing in the building with a tool that gives you some work with the students in a different reading plan. That's the beginning of the concept behind the program.
Thank you, Secretary. Any other questions? Representative Cox, go ahead.
Thank you. Chair Brown. Not sure who. Whoever wants to address this. This time, it's sure that I'm looking at the same standards and whatnot. Are the standards developed and published, and where does one find those standards?
The standards are virtually, they're standard across the country. There are different standards each district will indicate which one it's using, which definitely assessment goals it's using. Those are certainly probably not the same for every district, but there's a lot of consistency across the board. The department maintains reporting and access to those. I think existing commission would probably go into more detail as to how they. Assess the district using our tools because it's using that if it's any question because in every sports team there's a level of inconsistency in the state and the department's role is to kind of navigate that inconsistency and make sure that the standards being used in each district are meeting the needs, not just at the district but the student for this district. But if you take a right point that thing over to the assistant commissioner.
Thank you. And then through the chair, Deputy Commissioner Karen Moline. Through the chair, Representative Brex, I think if we're talking about standards in the world of public education, there's kind of two ways that we think about standards. One is in that we have a set of standards, but like, for instance, we have the rest of math standards and even some of our standards. We have gone through a rigorous process with various stakeholders to identify those things, those skills and knowledge that we might all of us as students know and be able to do. Those standards are published, when they first came out, they were printed, they're widely supported by the department as the standards of what a well-educated Alaska student would never be able to get. So in that respect of standards, there would be an identified set of standards that we would want our students in a pre-K or a K program to be able to do. So that's the standards. And at this point, in history, we just had some recently adopted early childhood standards, and that document is called the Early Learning Guidelines. And that is published, it's posted on the website. It went around the community, worked quite extensively on putting those standards together. So, so when it comes to setting a standard at the department, we have a process that we use that includes stakeholders. when it comes to assessment tools, those assessment tools and the identified benchmarks or accomplishment levels are identified by the assessment companies or whoever's creating assessment using accepted standards of what a student or a child of that age should know or be able to do. So they set their assessment based on those standards, and then when a student is below that expectation, an educator knows, oh, okay, I've got to intervene on the part of this, on behalf of the student to bring that up so that we are correct. So that's a little bit how standards work in the world of education.
I guess my question is there anything concrete already specifically published so that people can see what you're trying to accomplish? Is there something specifically published now, and where is that specific thing found?
Yes, thank you, through the chair, Representative Brooks. Yes, there are a set of standards of what is expected for students starting in pre-K, but K to know and be able to do. And those are posted on the website, and I believe there's printed copies of the early learning guidelines that we can make available, but you can access those on our website. And then beginning at kindergarten, we have the English Language Arts standards and the math standards for kindergarten through 12th grade on that, what students should be able to do.
Thank you. Representative Cox, we have kind of gotten off the track.
I understand.
And testimony, so let's try to turn it to questions to what has been testified to so far.
If you could just please send me a link to the specific things that you're talking about, so we know who is talking about the same thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Crofton, originally. Let's see, any further questions regarding Mr. Feinberg's
testimony? Thank you. Mr. Feinberg's testimony, I think it was his first and follow-up with the bill sponsor for additional information. Mr. Kinebauer, you were talking about the work that education the educators have for ensuring that students are assessed accurately and have to follow up on it. One of the concerns I had last year on my session was schools and teachers that are generally underperforming and have more individual reading plans for different students would probably see almost a cumulative buildup of those individual reading plans. And so I want to see and hear from your opinion about the supports by the concerns of educators about having too many individual reading plans in a classroom specifically for the supports that are around that teacher to be able to handle that workload. How do you see that impacting the teacher's workload and the ability to do their job and the supports in this bill?
Representative Hopkins, through the chair. Yes, thank you for the question. It's been a key issue for our members when we talk about caseload and workload and class size and relevant amounts to being able to meet the needs of every student that's in front of an educator in the class. And certainly we would hope and expect that those kinds of supports would absolutely be there. That some guidance, whether that came within a school, or if I came from a more detailed policy here, or if it came from data and the process to be able to make sure that the students' needs, their support, especially those that need additional intervention, doesn't become overly burdensome. I think the point of that and the previous question from Representative Sokowski is to make sure that we're meeting students' needs while at the same time making sure that we're providing those adequate supports, that, you know, testing is not driving what we're doing here, that it's certainly assessment, especially the formative assessment, students are learning are vital, but it needs to be integrated into what's being done. It needs to be, we need for local districts to make decisions that work best for that district to make sure that there aren't too many students in the same class that are on reading plans to be able to balance that out, to be able to provide professional development, to be able to provide additional support for the teachers in terms of classroom aids, in terms of limiting overall class size. So all of these are important questions, but we appreciate and definitely concerns for educators. And then there needs to be room too for individual educators to be able to manage their classrooms, because some of those classes to the students, they're the ones working with the students. They know what the students need, and that voice has to be represented as part of that process in developing whatever process is going on in an individual school, an individual district, and state level.
Thank you. I have a follow-up to another bill that's been sponsored by the Department of Ed. What structures do you have in place for a student or for a teacher or educator to back out? The small class size was a very effective support component from the department. That support component comes in three ways. The first way is that it provides a number of new positions that focus on reading within the department that are designed and set to work in individual districts. The second part is the integrated part where there's a lot of support for reading, teaching, and instruction in those districts, including creating opportunities for food and service training for teachers, etc. And then there was a third component that I think is a little bit weaker as well, but in the earlier versions of the which I hope you might take a look at, is to develop curriculum as well. But they include both support reading specialists, which are specific to local or rural communities of the federal planning department of education, where up to 10 provided for serving districts, teachers, and serving schools. In the earlier version, the same decision is by half that number in this. So both support reading specialists as well as identifying up to 10 schools that could qualify for specific support were being built specifically to address the most issues and bringing up represented or brought up numerous times by educators in particular in the world of being able to identify educators at different ends of the world of identifying reading specialists, in particular the educator professors brought to the community. So, there's an element of the bill that also to develop kind of reading capacity at the district. So, in a way, if you bring your reading capacity up to the district by training the trainers, if you will, training the teachers to take care of the teachers, then you can bring that capacity to the local district. Not that it exists, but they're paid, but you have that level today. And so, our teachers don't have the support from the department in order to start the districts themselves and that level of support. That's necessary because they have other items that you're working in the well-being program. I'm sure that they don't do it, but they struggle with it. So some districts be better than others depending on the resources, etc. But this bill tried to do was to have all those three concepts, early education, reading, in support of the early education reading component from the department. So that's what the bill, the reading section for the bill and the early ed section for the bill and text.
I may also, Madam Chair, mention that sometimes to me. So with that upfront support that we want to deliver, it's kind of a difficult one to gain. I mean, I was behind that. But potentially with the early interventions and with the early learning components of it, pre-K and so forth, that will make it easier. Yes, to, you know, we get involved in
get involved early in your child education, and make sure that you have a teacher in the classroom as well. So it is really a bit difficult thing to do as we get that support, but as we try to support, it's so important to make sure that happens.
Thank you, Mark. So, this is it.
Can you hear us?
Yes, I'm going to make sure. Return, I think, is because the internet was not. just an example of some of the problems and some of the challenges that we have. Say, what is your fiber that's going to be taking over that question?
Okay. Ms. Burgess, can you hear me?
Yes, Chairman, I can hear you just fine. Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Fine. Go ahead and introduce yourself and your family.
Thank you. Ms. Jamie Burgess, Superintendent for Nonprofit Schools. I apologize for our technical difficulties. As of now, the internet is still moving. For questions, I was able to push my 9 o'clock meeting to 10 o'clock. So I had opportunities to speak to you. That's how important this particular piece of legislation is to me. So I'm deporting, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today regarding House Bill 64. This is my 5th year working for Nonprofit Schools. And prior to becoming the superintendent, I was the director of federal programs and instruction, and I supervised the district's pre-K grant. So I am intimately familiar with the benefits of pre-K as seen in our students. So I appreciate Representative Duncan's invitation to address you and share testimony originally presented by the Senate Education Committee regarding Senate Bill 8. I was a strong supporter of Senate Bill 8 and actively supported the amended portion of the committee's substitute listing 111. And I'm pleased to testify for you today in support of Request 164, Resolution Number SB 111. I would like to emphasize that while my testimony is focused on the need for pre-K development in the state of Alaska, I fully support the premise that pre-K is a key part, but not the only part, of comprehensive reading legislation. So today I would like to share with you some data from our school district showing the connection between a high-quality pre-K program and improved student achievement. I fully acknowledge that the data set is small, since the number is small school district, and this does not fit any of the criteria for a rigorous scientific study. However, the patterns I will point out to you this morning can be seen here in our district on a consistent basis, and I believe provides an example of anecdotal evidence of the impact of pre-K in rural districts for both primarily the children of color. I'd like to begin by giving the community a little background on what pre-K development has looked like in the community of Nome. So as you can see on the second slide in my presentation, the community of Nome has had two long-standing avenues for preschool. Nome Preschool, which is a private nonprofit organization originally founded in 1970 by local parents, and Kowarik's Head Start program, which serves not only Nome, but many of the surrounding villages in the Bering Strait region. Beginning in 2009, Nome Public Schools received a state preschool grant, and we began a formal partnership with these two entities to improve the quality of available preschool programming. Nome Public Schools offers two half-day classes, one for 4-year-olds and one for 3-year-olds, with a maximum of 40 children in each class. Head Start offers classrooms with half-day programs. Head Start prioritizes 4-year-olds in each classroom, but will fill available spots for 3-year-olds up to a maximum of 20 children in each classroom. Historically, the number of 4-year-old children attending preschool has remained fairly steady at about 40, while Nome Elementary School sees about 60 students in its three kindergarten classrooms each year. This means approximately 20 children, or one-third of the student population, enters kindergarten each year without attending either program. A few in this group attended preschool in another area prior to their families relocating to them, but the majority have not attended any form of preschool program anywhere. While local schools have had the state preschool grant the opportunity to place a certified early education teacher in each of these three preschool classrooms. However, we seldom had three teachers at any one time, due to the difficulty of finding early education certified teachers and retaining them as well. In the latter years of the grant, uncertainty around the funding of the grant each year often extending into the early summer months created the almost impossible task of finding a high quality early education certified teacher in June or July when the teacher pool was almost completely dry. Eventually, as you can see on slide 4, the district was able to find a single preschool teacher. And we had to decline the grant in the fall of 2019, meaning our last year, but the certified teacher in the program was the 2018-2019 school year. If you look at slide 5, this shows data from the fall administration of the DIBELS assessment for all kindergarten for children in 2016. And no, DEMOS stands for the Dynamic Indicators of Basic Early Literacy Skills. It is a nationally recognized assessment for determining if children are developing foundational literacy skills, which are basically the same as fluency and comprehension and reading. Two of the earliest assessments in the DEMOS suite are given in kindergarten. The LMF, or Letter Meaning Fluency Assessment, asks children to identify as many letters as they can in the space of 1 minute. And the FSF, or First Sound Fluency Assessment, asks children to identify the first sound in a short three-letter word that is written. The graph in slide 5 compares the percentage of kindergarten children reaching the proficiency benchmark on each assessment who attended preschool to those who did not. And as you can clearly see, there's a significant difference. On slide number 6, the same cohort of children is shown 2 years later when they followed their second grade year. Taking the MAP, or Measure for Academic Progress Reading Assessment. MAP is another nationally developed assessment which compares children across the country taking the same assessment at the same time to each other. Typically, the benchmark for grade level performance in the MAP test is around 40%. Bloom Elementary looks for children falling below 25% on the assessment as candidates for reading intervention. As you can see on the slide, children who have not attended preschool are much more likely to be identified as needing to be enrolled in the district's reading intervention program. Slide number 7 shows a different profile of kindergartners, this time in the fall of 2018, and their performance on the ANASPA developmental profile. This is an assessment given by kindergarten teachers after 4 weeks of observing their students' performance on 13 different goals clustered with 5 domains. Students are scored with a 2, which means successfully demonstrating this desired skill by nature, and 1, which means sometimes demonstrating the desired skill of behavior, or a 0, which means solving or never demonstrating the desired skill of behavior. As far as parents need to meet the goal, then the state of Alaska defines kindergarten ready as a child receiving a score of 2, or at least 11 out of the 13 goals. In this slide, not only are children who did or did not attend preschool in here, but also those who attended a preschool classroom led by a teacher certified by the state of Alaska in early education. But only 17% of all the children assessed that year met at least 11 out of the 13 goals. When that group was split into children with or without preschool, the preschool children group this time was larger, and the children with a certified teacher in their preschool program was the largest group of all. On slide number 8, the same cohort of children is shown with their 5-5 rating scores. 70% of the children who had attended preschools scored at the 5th percentile or higher, indicating that they most people are public, while only 55% of the students who did not attend preschool met the same benchmark. On slide 9, the group of children in the previous slide who did attend preschool was further broken out into those that had a certified teacher and those who did not. In that group, 75% of the children had the benefit of a certified teacher in the classroom. One of the aspects of Health Bill 64 is the requirement for a funded preschool program to be led by a high-quality teacher. In the absence of one public schools providing a certified teacher for preschool classroom, our kindergarten organizations fill their teacher positions with staff of varying educational background and experience, as shown in slide 10. While these individuals do their best and may receive some training from their organization, their knowledge of best practices in early education and especially early literacy development are often lacking. My most experienced kindergarten teacher who has been teaching for 15 years at Bloom Elementary School was asked to describe her general impressions of incoming kindergarten students since the last of certified teachers in the preschool programs in Bloom. She stated, "I have noticed a significant change last year with the incoming kindergartners in 2019-2020. Remember, these are the students in the last year's head group who quite often were not a certified teacher. It was one of the lowest students I've ever had. I had to rethink how I did my center to meet the needs of my students." Another kinder teacher who worked in the preschool program most of the children in her class, but she also had in her preschool class, and her class had high scores. Even before the shutdown, March 2020, another rookie class in the incoming kindergarten class for 2020-2021. We did not have enough staff at Head Start, and so the classes were being rotated. For example, the blueberry class was homeschooled for 2 weeks, and it was a Vanguard group's turn. So they were not getting a full year of preschool even before the shutdown. This really showed that SES students don't just initial learning skills in the students are here. They really had to work on how they were schooled and how they interacted with each other. Any interesting courses going on around the state and in elementary school still has a long way to go with all of our students reading at grade level by third grade. The school received a designation for comprehensive support in 2018, meaning it was identified as one of the lowest credible schools in our state. Subsequently, we applied for and received one of the Alaska State Comprehensive Literacy Grants, and we have been working exceptionally diligently to increase the knowledge and capacity of our elementary teachers to be effective in teaching children to read. The presence of preschool alone does not solve all of our issues. However, as you can see from the data I've shown today, the absence of high-quality preschool programs creates an additional hurdle. Teachers must work even harder to overcome. Having reliable funding to create a solid, consistent preschool program is a key foundational step to move closer to our ultimate goal and allow students to read at or above grade level, especially in the area of literacy. I'd like to conclude by saying that age 164 has brought of superintendents across the state of Alaska. When Senator Baker was working on the originally SB6 in last year's legislative session, he worked very closely with the Alaska Superintendents Association and many other members of the Educational Committee over many months to address that concern and end his bill in response while still maintaining his original intent. I believe it is unique to find education bills which so intimately involve educators and education leaders in their creation and development. And this legislation provides a unique opportunity to have a significant impact on legislation in Alaska. It's time for us to put our money where our mouth is, invest intelligently in our country's future, which is the real future of our state. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Are still alive and well. Some of our partnership with them remains just very cordial. We don't actually have certified teachers working with them, and we're not certainly working with any of them with their staff. But both of those, both the Head Start and the preschool, are still active today.
So then you are providing a service in addition to what Young Preschool and Head Start was providing. Is that understanding correct? My understanding
correct? Yes, you are correct. So both programs have, they have a program. However, when we have the grant, we actually hired and placed the certified teachers or employees of Young Public Schools into their classrooms without the presence of certified teachers. Both those organizations tend to hire locally, local individuals who are not certified teachers, and their background and their knowledge and their best practices are really talents that may be limited or are limited to what professional development those organizations can provide. But Head Start does a better job of providing professional development simply because it's a larger and much better funded organization. The preschools are currently funded by tuition and fundraising from our organization, and so they just weren't allowed providing anything to their teachers other than occasionally they were able to send them to the state coordinators.
Just a question, I was thinking, mean, there's kind of a head start in the preschool program. Is that right?
Yes, I am. My internet focus that has been a little bit of work, but that's unfortunately I did not hear what I was supposed to do.
Their program is providing certified teachers to the non-entry school and the Head Start program. Is that correct?
Yes, George, when we had the grant from the state, we were able to afford that. That is, that was all those positions were grant funded. When we have our work that we had to sign the grant, because we the funding was so uncertain, we actually had a notification that they were going to fund the grant until so late in the year, we were unable to find any actual teachers to hire. What positions you previously had either resigned or had already transferred into other positions within the district.
Probably put us in that bottom category or right above.
We have a variety of assessments. Most of the districts around the state, like Michigan, are using MAP or measures of academic progress. Most of us like that particular assessment. It has actually been thought of as a potential replacement for PEEPS. But I know that there are some issues with trying to use that. I really believe that I mentioned the tools which we use. There's another very similar reading assessment called Ames Web that we can use. Most districts don't use the bones, but use Ames Web instead. Both of those are very short, very focused. They don't take any particular amount of time in the classroom. They are somewhat subjective because they're teacher, like I said, they're very short and they're administered by teachers. The individual children, actually, the teacher will come and assess their own students. So I believe that there are probably some. I don't know if this piece is necessarily the best one to rank how things are, how your reading program is happening in K-1 and 2, but MAP most definitely would be very, very easy to access information on individual students, individual schools, and individual districts very quickly for districts to provide to the state. So that's one possibility as well.
Thank you. Both Mayor and Governor Stephen Hopkinson is here. On page 9, starting on 9 to 17 there, I think you might have referred to an older version of the ranking is, but basically, for my formal approval plans and review, the subset of powers of paraphrase and ultimate districts and all the series based on the permits of my ten districts under the subsection. This is the base permit, it's like the thing you might have been referring to a previous version. First year, second year, and the fourth is for basically all of it. Basically, what it's going to do is consider the subsection would be their eligibility for the grant, but the lower performance. Right? If we're not going to come in, the lower performance is your question. Yes, sir. That's the Department of Education. If not, I'm not going to see that very true.
Yes, I am. Yes, the question is, if I understand it correctly, Madam Chair, is to the ranking of schools and the way that the department does it, how that's happening. Is that again the question on the table? Representative Hopkins, the early education grants are administered through an application process, and they are separately how individual schools are identified as needing support. So at this time, the only across the state data that the state collects is on PEEPS. That's the assessment data that we collect. And so in our accountability process, we have the PEEP score and then a number of other indicators that is the overall look at that school's performance. It's not just on the PEEP scoring. So the indication of where a school ranks takes into consideration all of the indicators on the state accountability system. And the reason that we use that is because that's the only data that we have that we reliably collect at this point. We don't have, as a state, one assessment that's used widely across the state as an early literacy screener. As Superintendent Burgess mentioned, public schools use DIBELS as their early literacy screener to identify students that might be struggling. She also indicated that some districts use Ames Web, others use MAP, early literacy screener. There's a number of different tools being used across the state, but the state department does not collect data from one particular assessment tool. that would be one of the powerful things that could come about from this, is that, that the state would be able to truly collect data that can be comparable. At this point, to compare things like bibbles isn't really doable right now. So I hope that answers your question, and I'm happy to answer any follow-ups.
I need to move on to Mr. Morton's testimony because we have another bill to consider this morning, and there are a number of folks that you have for public testimony for that bill. So, good morning, Ruhr. Please put your name and affiliation on the record and proceed with your testimony, and I really appreciate you waiting patiently.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? I'm Culture.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Good morning, Culture. I'm one of the members of the House Education Committee. For the record, my name is Norman. I'm the Director of Advocacy for the Association of Alaska School Boards, and I also thank you for the opportunity to testify. Please indulge me for just a moment to put my testimony into context. The 2021 first session of the 32nd Legislature marks the 36th year I came to Juneau to advocate on behalf of students, both as a school board member and now as an AASB employee. In those 36 years, the most important item I've been a part of as a member of the educational advocacy team has been the 1987 rewrite of the foundation program. That is until today. The opportunity to offer support for HB 164 as well as the Senate companion bill, SB 111, rises to the top of the importance to education in my 36 years of working with the legislature. Madam Co-Chair, HB 164, in my opinion, is a game changer for Alaska students. I want to thank the committee for your willingness to do the heavy lifting and introduce this bill. I stand ready to offer my support and assistance to get HB 164 across the finish line. Our proponents of the CS for HB 164 that are especially appreciated by my members. We are not fearful of accountability and believe that it is appropriate for our communities, our families, and students, and the accountability provisions within this bill are reasonable. The strong elements for professional development will assist educators in meeting the needs of their students. Higher rigorous professional standards that prepare teachers for reading instruction and early education will serve students well. And to go along with professional standards, the assurance that early education programs are appropriate and utilizing research-based strategies will prepare those children well for successful educational experiences throughout the entire system. We especially appreciate defining the elements of an evidence-based reading education, from mimical artists, audits, vocabulary development, reading fluency, oral language skills, and reading comprehension. The ability to read well is the fundamental basis for a good education, and HB 164 emphasizes this. Provisions for rapid, timely, and immersive interventions for students in need of additional help is critical and addressed in the bill. The emphasis on increasing parental engagement in the education of children, particularly in reading, is welcome. The assistance of need in those interventions.
times are concerning that the bill is shared with you. We are disappointed that funding for universal pre-K is not possible at this time, due to the fiscal cliff facing the state. Our hope is that by the time of the repeal of this program arrives, the state will be in a better fiscal position, and the results will show the success of early education, as has already been proven in several of Alaska's school districts. We would have liked to see the pre-K counts under the ADA not capped by an appropriation, but we are grateful for what is in the bill. In the reporting requirements, there is a requirement to report the number of administrators compared to the total number of students. I'm not opposed to this, but it is sometimes too easy to find additional funding by merely reducing the number of administrators. Administrators are the educational leaders in every school district and provide the leadership and oversight that is essential to good student achievement. This includes superintendents, principals, central office personnel, and specialists. My only request is not to think of these professionals as expendables, but rather as part of a team that is working in concert with classroom teachers to increase student achievement. And finally, while I am still concerned with the repeals for so many programs in HB 6164, making the 12 repeals consistent with one day does avoid confusion. Madam Co-Chair, my concerns are not intended to cast any hesitancy on my support of HB 164. I'm confident that teachers and administrators in Alaska school districts will utilize early education, evidence-based reading instructions, interventions for students not meeting proficiency, and family-based partnerships to make a difference in the lives of Alaska young people. I'm also confident that the annual reports to the legislature will show improvements in standardized test results. Thank you for the opportunity this morning, and thank you to represent the Education Committee for your advocacy of our students. And that concludes my testimony, Madam Co-Chair.
So much more than the journey of this morning in our life. So appreciate your commitment. I know I've not met you in 1994, 95, you're already been at it for at least 10 years. In cardiac cells, but we really appreciate your advocacy for kids in Alaska over all these years. Representative Zelensky, that's the first question.
So I'm trying to know trying to keep staying on track here and then have an agenda. But I did want to ask, I just want to double check, I'm sure we can always be able to see you. If you can remind me, you are working with the Association of Alaska School Boards, is that correct?
To the chair, Lepreski, I was executive director of the association for 6 years, and I stepped down in January, and my replacement, Ron Garrison, took over, and I moved into the position of director of advocacy for the association.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you. In your assessment of this legislation, Mr. Woodman, I'm curious what conversations you've had with districts that are implementing Indigenous language immersion programs and the overlap that the standards set out in this policy would have on school districts, particularly in rural areas that may be operating immersion programs.
Yes, to the chair, Representative Lepreski, thanks for that question. We are in strong support of Indigenous language instruction and recovery of Indigenous languages within school districts. In fact, the association has 4 resolutions passed by our government assembly that support language immersion, including language immersion programs. The phrase culturally responsive is something that we supported very strongly in SB 111, and we're gratified that it's in SB 164, because that term to us, culturally responsive, means that, that local school districts are able to address many issues within the district, not only about the customs and so forth that they exist in the districts, but also in regard to language and language immersion. Language immersion programs. And so we believe that this bill will be consistent with those programs and will, in fact,
especially during this month.
Representative Duck, I was wondering if there has been collaboration in areas where, as I read the bill, it seems to focus really heavily on English literacy. Can you talk a little bit about, if there's an area or if there's a school district that maybe considered a government school district that believes in English literacy, but that also provide immersion programs? Has there been considerations or amendments that might ensure that literacy education could be considered in multiple languages, particularly indigenous languages?
Thank you for that question. And I'll turn to the chair, Representative Duncan. One of the things that we have written throughout the bill is making sure that we're not referring to English or cognitive reading literacy. And the reason for that is because the diversity that we have in Alaska, with languages that kind of preserve languages that we have. And I can tell you that really indigenous tribal literature are enterprise topics and an amazing job here in the capital to make sure that we get the language immersion programs for native languages. You're out here at Sitcom, and it's really a capital for the past week, but the amount of support that I've been holding here is trying to get that in. And no way would we want to jeopardize that. Also know that the best time you can introduce a second language to a child is age 3. And that's one of the nice things about the parents' teaching component in here, because then you're able to be culturally responsive, and with tribal organizations, you're able to take that over, and you're able to have customized programs for those families and those communities to be able to bring that out to the child's anywhere. So there really is an emphasis, and we're trying to make that emphasis on. Making sure that it's not just reading for English, it's any type of reading literacy. And I really point out on page 3 of the bill, and that's in English as well, but specifically line 3, you will find culturally responsive intervention strategies and reading literacy services provided under statute.
Next up, our first hearing on House Bill 21, adding a faculty member to the University Board of Regents. Sponsored by the staff of the Board of Regents. Put themselves on the record.
This bill does, for example, that
places at the principal and ninth to the student faculty, student agreement, which the university currently has, and had since 1976. So it's not a new program in the student region, but in the board region. And I think the district just provides parity and fairness to also have a here. The reason we've been here for faculty members for many years. And we've been a representation on the board in the past. In the region meetings, there's a table with the regents, and there's another slide table where other university attorneys and other people can sit, and their faculty members have a seat at the junior table, but never a seat at the big table. Never been a voting member, never been allowed into the executive session. The student region is allowed into the executive session. The student region is a voting member, and we're just asking for the same for faculty region. During the tumultuous times of a few years ago, there was discussion of unifying consolidating the university into three separate universities, one university. The faculty said, we don't have a voice in this discussion. And this will give them a voice that they might want. So I think it's fair, I think it's balanced. 25 board university assistants and 5 states of the faculty division as board assistants. And I think it's been a long time coming. You might hear from others, and I've heard it, I've heard pushback from regents in the past, and they say, well, this is a conflict of interest that doesn't belong to me, I'm not a board of regents. How can I make decisions about things that will affect them? Salary, program cuts, so on and so forth. But for one, directly affect them to recuse themselves. Two, you can say the same about the student region. If they have a program that's meant to be cut, that would directly affect them. If there's a tuition hike, which quite often there is in the board region just above that, it will directly affect them as well. So they don't think of whatever this conflict of interest that exists for faculty also goes to students, so they have a little bit of that in 10 to 7 years. So, this is, I think it's good for fairness and openness and evenness, and it's quite good to move forward. And actually, I want to.
Thank you.
If any questions are having, you can go to the rest of the question.
Great. I'm Dr. Bashley, Director of Representative Rule. And for the time, I will describe the main overview page that I want to emphasize. And I'll just briefly walk through a couple of additional points and references. So first off, we do right now have 10 regents, but sort of 8 years. These are public members of the board that are appointed by the government. Additionally, there is one student regent, as I mentioned previously. The student regent functions a little differently in that it's over a 2-year term. They must be elected by their campus, and there's a petition process followed by a nomination process with each campus and city government. So that process is a little bit different than regents or public members of the board. However, student regents do have full board powers. They can vote, they can go to executive session, as was mentioned, and they also have a travel power to attend regent meetings. Additionally, they must meet a standard of having that 2.5 in order to join. And the current rule of faculty on the Board of Regents is simply that the faculty line takes a labor report at each Board of Regents meeting. And it also has speaking rights for the faculty alliance. This is different than Ms. Representative Wall mentioned, being at the big table, being a full member of the Board of Regents. Just looking at a state by state comparison, I think that the second bullet point here, there are actually 5, not 6 state universities that have a faculty region. And the green states on this map are the 16 state universities that have a student region. Additionally, there are 4 states with hash marks. These are the state universities that have both a faculty and student region as a member of their board. This also, in addition to 15% of graduate students across the country that have a faculty region. There are 25 public university systems that are not part of the state university, but are public university systems that also have a faculty region. And a couple of things to note here. One reference to student region or faculty region, which also can be referencing those boards that have those as full voting members,
Thank you.
Texas State School. Thank you both for your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The sponsors of this matter is speak to newly appointed by Dr. Turkey and our board how any sort of call votes would be negotiated.
In a previous iteration of this bill, we had it, but if we have to have the answer, we don't have to be the tiebreaker. And some voices on this committee, in the previous legislature, was pushed back on that. And so we just laughed at that. We didn't even remember, and even the majority of the panel, some of the tribe, the vote for the help, we got the compulsory vote. And some argue that the US 6-5 vote got it pretty close. And to be passed on a six-five version. And if that number would be the same as the second vote, I guess that would be an important thing. But the time, the time goes, is a lot to take down. Maybe not next year.
No questions at this time. We have sick people online for public testimony, so we'll be waiting patiently since before they come. So we have open public testimony. I want to thank all of you for hanging in there with us this morning. I'm going to call on Heather Batchelder first, please. Heather, can you hear me?
Yes, thank you.
And I'm going to be an affiliation of the record and proceed with your testimony. I'll let you have 3 minutes.
Good morning. I'm a representative for the record. My name is Heather Batchelder. I'm the past faculty senate president of the UNF and the current chair of the Faculty Alliance, which is comprised of the future past and present faculty senate presidents from each university. I'm here to discuss the values of law in House Bill 21. Past faculty members are currently, as you speak, only at the board meeting for under 6 or 7 minutes to provide their own report and I'm able to answer questions from majors. Faculty members seem to have the faculty voice be a more active part of the UAP board of majors would be beneficial. Faculty members supports the bill to ensure that it will be well received by our policy agency, NWCCU, as well. Ideally, members from the faculty senate's chosen for each university for the main student phone to the governor would be those who have served on the faculty senate and therefore for our faculty employees as well. This again, we have to encourage our legislators regarding the cost of the study and employees. Faculty are dedicated across the system to our three separately accredited universities. And that's committed to collaboration and bookstores that is close to our library administration. So, as far as conflict of interest, we serve and share several scripts typically a family and we serve in system level meetings as well. And we want our teams ourselves.
Mr. Blitzo, are you available?
Yes, sir.
Please put your name and your
Okay.
It is a finding that this dysfunctional parenting has to be removed. And regarding the all given issue, we have a very different position. Instead of one second in a month, we have two times.
same story. Thank you, Project Allen, and thank you, Robert Thurman, for bringing us back to this. I do believe that on the basis we have my support and round out our Board of Regents. Having said that, do we have an extremely large of regents for the current president of the university and any faculty members?
Hospital 48, Alaska Performance Fellowship.